Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and our guest this week, Heather Chisvin. Each week at this time, we visit with a local author, we get an introduction to their work and perhaps a glimpse into their lives. We ask them what prompts them to write and give them an opportunity to read from their work. This week, we're very pleased to have Heather Chisvin join us. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
Heather was born in Winnipeg to Jewish parents, whose own parents emigrated from Russia to escape the pogroms there. She studied English and philosophy at the University of Manitoba and then worked as a print journalist in Winnipeg and then with CBC as producer. She moved to Toronto to become a researcher with W5, then moved back to CBC and produced radio documentaries. Later, she went into advertising as an associate creative director and taught advertising copywriting at OCAD, before going freelance doing all the things she'd been doing for years. 10 years ago, she moved to Port Hope with her partner, novelist Kurt Palka. They have 3 daughters from previous marriages and 5 granddaughters under 5.
We do.
Heather has just published her first novel. So Heather, your first novel is titled A Fist Around the Heart, which is quite an emotional image, isn't it?
Yes.
And I believe it's set in Winnipeg, and the protagonists are 2 sisters who were sent there by their parents to keep them safe from anti-Jewish feeling, which led to the pogroms in Russia during the later 19th century. Tell us a little about those sisters and their lives in New York and Winnipeg.
Okay. They were very different sisters. When they lived in Russia, they were probably very similar in terms of being playful and free and safe. When their parents sent them away, things changed dramatically. Esther, the older sister, became quiet, withdrawn, frightened somehow. Anna, whose pet name was Benki, saw what was going on. She seemed to be the only one that saw what was going on. And she felt a great need to look after her older sister. She felt protective, as a mother would towards a child. It was a very maternal relationship. The time in Winnipeg was difficult for both of them, probably. Esther tried very, very hard to fit in with the family, the Protestant family that they had been sent to Winnipeg with. Their parents sent them so they would escape the pogroms mm-hmm. and promised they would join them later, but that's part of the book. Did they join, and did they join them later, or didn't they join them later? Esther tried very much to fit in with the classical Protestant, I'm a lady type of living, while Anna was very much, she was very iconoclastic. She was clumsy and tall and wore a patch over one eye as she was growing up, but she was fiercely intelligent and interested in things that were going on in the world, and ultimately made her way to New York as Esther stayed in Winnipeg and married a very respectable lawyer in New York.
Hmm. 2 very different sisters.
Right.
Yes. Now, you would think that perhaps the trigger for the plot would be your own personal history, and maybe there's a little bit of that in there, but you've said that the trigger for the plot was finding out about something called IF Day by chance on the internet. So tell us, what is IF Day?
IF Day, I was quite surprised. I don't know what I was looking for when I came across something that said IF Day in Winnipeg, and I went to look at it, and it was a day when the Victory Bonds Committee staged a simulated Nazi invasion to raise money for the war through Victory Bonds. And they did a remarkable job. They enlisted 3,500 people who had been and still were in the armed forces. This was February the 1942, so the war is still on. They rented Hollywood costumes from Hollywood. They painted planes and tanks over with the Black Cross of the Wehrmacht. And they invaded the city at dawn. They staged a blowing up of a bridge. They arrested City Hall officials. They took over a radio station and established a curfew. Everybody had to billet 5 Nazi soldiers. And I read all this, and I couldn't believe that I wasn't alive when that happened, but my parents never told me about it, nor did the parents of any of my friends who grew up in Winnipeg, because I checked with them all. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, what would happen if somebody thought it was the real thing?
Yeah.
And so I started to put together a story, and I had no desire to write fiction up until then, because I was still doing all the other kinds of writing, but it kind of took over my life.
Wow, that's remarkable in little old Winnipeg. Like, who would have thought? So why do you think so few people do know about it. And how do you think your own parents and the Jewish community would have reacted at the time?
I don't know why so few people know so little about it. It happened right after War of the Worlds, which was that Orson Welles radio show that in New York. And maybe the Victory Bonds people thought, whoa, that was a good idea. I can only think that not too many people talked about it because it was a horrible thing to do. There was a war going on in Europe and people were being killed, and this was a simulation of the same thing. Now, the Victory Bonds Committee at the time said they were doing it, that they called it If Day because they wanted to show you what if it were happening here. This is what it would be like if you were at the front fighting. So that's why they did it. It raised quite a bit of money, millions of dollars. How did my own parents feel about it? I have no idea. It was never mentioned.
Oh, you haven't had get a chance to ask them before you found out about it?
No, my parents are long gone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
It had a lot of coverage, but I didn't read anything negative about it.
Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit and ask you to tell us about the research that you undertook into life in New York, Winnipeg, and Russia during the period of your novel. Did your family history play into that?
Well, it did, although, like a lot of immigrants, I can't remember direct conversations with my parents. They were 3 and 4, respectively, when they came over. And I can't remember conversations with my grandparents or my parents about what it was like, not that my parents would remember much. It was like they didn't want to talk about it, like it didn't exist because it was such a horrific time in their lives. But I do have, and I treasure it, a little story that my mother's sister, Rose, wrote. She was older than my mother, and she remembered when they were in their little village, and the Russian soldiers came in and knocked my grandmother's teeth out and took the one good suit that my Uncle Charlie had in that little village. So I had that. And I think somehow, even though things aren't talked about, they seep into your bones, and you feel like you're familiar with it, even if you're not. That's Winnipeg and that's Russia. I also did a tremendous amount of historical research just to find out what was going on at the time, you know, the assassination of the Tsar, the Russian Revolution. In terms of New York, I haven't lived there, but a sister of mine lived there for many years. I visited a lot and I love New York. I loved it then and I still do. But I have probably 35 books on each area that I swallowed whole. I'm a researcher by profession, so I couldn't stop researching once I
That's
once
always
I started.
The danger, isn't it?
Yes, I love doing research.
When does the research end and the writing begin?
That's right.
You know, you've been a documentary producer and copywriter and all these other forms of communication. So what made you decide to write a novel?
Well, finding out about If Day, it kind of took over. Okay. I didn't say I'm going to write a novel. I found out about this and I kept thinking what would happen if somebody didn't know, and the novel just started, and then I became obsessed with the whole thing.
And was it a good journey?
It was a good journey, and it was a horrible journey. It took me 5 years. I would say the first 3 years, I had to teach myself how to write fiction, which is so very different than any kind of journalism or advertising. I had been used to making everything smaller. You've got 30 seconds for an ad, and you've got a certain amount of space for a newspaper article, and I had to learn that I could lie and make things up and make things longer rather than shorter. And it was frustrating. Many times I just put it aside and said, I can't do that, but I kept sneaking my way back to it because I was just attracted to the whole thing. And in the end, it's tremendously satisfying. I don't want to write anything else from now on.
Good. Perhaps you'll read to us a little.
Mm-hmm. I'll start with the beginning of the book. It's dedicated to Kurt and Elena, my daughter, and Hazel, my granddaughter. And the epigraph is, maybe all one can do is hope to end up with the right regrets, which is a quote from Arthur Miller's The Crucible. And that is what I feel the book is really about, making decisions and hoping that the regrets that you're left with, that you hope that they're the right ones. Mm-hmm. Esther is in her room again, crying. I can see it still so clearly. I knock softly on her door. Esther, may I come in? The crying stops. I imagine she's lifting her tear-streaked face from the pillow and turning to the door. I'll be fine, Banky, she says. You don't have to wait there. She won't be fine. I know that now about my sister. I also know that she will, sooner or later, let me in. So I slide slowly down the wall and pull my knees up to my chest, hoping the Countess doesn't come by and see me sitting like this. I begin stroking the green velvet runner that Bridget has just brushed to a fine pile and start counting. 150 strokes takes about 5 minutes. At 500, I get up and walk to the tall window that overlooks the back of the estate. Yellow leaves are skimming along the riverbank. Moses is turning his wagon around at the kitchen entrance and heading for the main road, his egg baskets knocking gently against each other. I had hoped to put on my boy's clothes and sneak out on his rounds with him, but it's too late now. I go back to Esther's closed door, slide down the wall again, and wait until she lets me in. "It happened again, Banky," she says, when we're settled on her bed, my back against the puffy velvet headboard, her head in my lap. "What happened, Esther?" I know, of course, what happened. I also know that it calms her to have me there, so we sit, the sun seeping in around the edges of the closed curtains, outlining a room that's larger than our whole house had been in Russia. I brush the moist strands of hair from her face, her blonde tendrils dark with tears. I had so wanted to go around the city with Moses. I would have climbed up beside him and held the reins, clucking at Ron to go or stop or turn, leaves and gravel crunching under the wagon wheels. "Will you be all right, Esther?" I ask. I must have asked her that question 1,000 times. I asked when she was 7 and I was 11. I asked when I was 11 and she was 15. I asked until I couldn't bear asking anymore. I still don't know which was harder, not asking and not knowing, or asking and hearing her answer. Sometimes I'm afraid I'll die of this.
Oh, dear. We've been talking with Heather Chisbin, novelist of A Fist Around the Heart, and we'll talk to her a little more after we take this short break.